trust you with that?
Good morning. Good morning. This is going to be a tough crowd to quiet down, I can tell already. But we would like to get started. Thank you. Good morning. On behalf of the Aspen Institute, I'd like to welcome you to the first full day of Aspen Ideas Festival 2009. I want to compliment you all on being here. Not only was it early, it wasn't easy to get tickets for this event, so I know this is sort of these are the overachievers for the Aspen Ideas Festival, and I welcome you all. I think you're going to be glad to be here. I was just talking with David. You need to know that this is not his first early morning here in Aspen. Yesterday morning at 6 a.m., he was being interviewed in the Dora Hosier Center for a live broadcast to Beijing. So he was sharing his wisdom with the press corps in Beijing yesterday. Today he's going to be sharing this, giving us equal time. So please pay attention. David Smick keeps a low profile, but experts consider him one of the most insightful financial market strategists in the world. For more than two decades, he has conferred with central bankers such as Alan Greenspan and Ben Bernanke. He's advised top Wall Street executives and investors from George Soros to Michael Steinhardt to Stan Druckenmiller. Political leaders have regularly sought his advice. This morning, he is yours. So please welcome David Smick.
Well, I appreciate you all coming out. Can everyone hear me? Okay. I once gave one of these talks, and halfway through, people said, we can't hear you in the back. And I said, I'll start again. I really appreciate this opportunity to be. I had no idea Aspen was so beautiful in the summer. It's really terrific. And I'd love to talk about my book, The World is Curved, but also really to give you a sense of where I think, of how I think we got into this mess, and where I think we're going. I have maintained a very low-key profile. I haven't been written any books before. I made the mistake at a Washington dinner party about 6 months or so before the subprime crisis hit. I was saying that this is what people do in Washington. In other parts of the country, they talk about nice things. I said, the financial markets look great. Everything looks perfect, but there are real problems ahead, and there are cracks in the system. So on the way home, my wife, Vicky, who was in the corner over here, said, you should write a book on the subject. And I said, what? And she said, no, you should write a book saying what you think and make it so that I can understand it, my friends can understand it. So I went ahead, and the book is called The World is Curved, Hidden Dangers to the Global Economy. And I'm told that the paperback is coming out later, and I had considered changing the title to taking the word hidden out of the subtext. The book, as when I thought about writing a book on essentially globalization, I went back and read a lot of the books that had been written on the subject, and first one I read was Tom Friedman, a friend of mine. His book, The World is Flat, which is a brilliant book. It's an important book, a historic book, on the revolution in the global supply chain for goods and services. But the more I thought about my experiences, which were about 23 years mostly in the hedge fund and the financial investment arena, I began to think, in the financial world, the world isn't flat, it's curved, in the sense that you can't see the dangers looming over the horizon, because financial markets lack transparency. And what I'm talking about is essentially it's the Norwegian village that has to shut down its daycare centers and elementary schools because its financial managers invested in a Citigroup product, a collateralized debt obligation that went belly up and an ocean away, and suddenly a Norwegian school was affected. So I began the book by trying to describe, and I've set down some thoughts here for you, and how we got into this mess and where we're going. You know, when people ask me what fundamentally caused the financial crisis, my answer is not always what they expect. I respond with one phrase, the fall of the Berlin Wall. By the early 1990s, after the collapse of the socialist model, emerging market economies such as China, India, Eastern Europe, and the commodity producers wanted to be like us. They wanted to be capitalists, and they became pretty good at it, making their economies more productive. This had the effect of lowering real wage costs globally, and while setting up these economies as powerful exporters. And soon, a global ocean of capital, of excess savings, was beginning to swirl around a liberalized worldwide financial system. And partly as a consequence of the Asian crisis of the late 90s, most of these emerging market economies adopted a new model, a new export-oriented model for success. They tied their currencies to the U.S. dollar and refashioned their economies as large export platforms. The target, the U.S. consumer, who fairly quickly became the world's consumer of last resort. As large parts of the world set up shop as a giant export engine, the low-saving U.S. consumer became almost addicted to consumption. As we kept consuming, many of the world's economies began stockpiling large amounts of excess savings. This reliance on exports in lieu of developing consumer-based economies created enormous global savings imbalances. In China alone, excess savings in the form of central bank reserves quickly approached $2 trillion. The problem was that there were too few investment opportunities for so much capital. A lot of this excess savings was recycled back into the U.S. financial system, usually in the form of fixed income purchases, with U.S. Treasury securities a prime target. This dangerous ocean of capital, which again reduced global wage demands, allowed American policymakers to think they had defied the laws of gravity. This was the period when Alan Greenspan was called the maestro and attempted to tame the business cycle. At one point, the Fed launched a series of rate hikes, that is, hikes in short-term interest rates, and long-term rates not only failed to rise but dropped. That's not supposed to happen, and in the process, financial risk became underpriced. Long-term interest rates dropped to unrealistic lows. And in the process, Wall Street thought it had discovered riskless risk. Because the global economy was out of balance, Americans went on a credit binge. U.S. household debt soared from 75% of annual disposable income in 1990 to 130% just before the crisis. In the height of this period, gluttonous American consumers were spending $1.10 for every dollar they earned, propping up a global economy. During the administration of George W. Bush, the world economy would have grown at an annual rate of less than 1% without a steady stream of private equity loans, according to economist Neil Ferguson, who I believe is speaking later on. And why were private equity loans so attractive? Because this dangerous ocean of capital in our interlinked financial system had unrealistically reduced long-term rates or interest rates to unheard-of low levels. This was a situation that was unsustainable. Asset prices, including the price of housing, shot through the roof with a little response from the regulators, including the Federal Reserve. At the same time, U.S. monetary policy remained extraordinarily accommodative. With the regulators asleep at the switch, here was a giant bubble certain to burst. But perhaps the greatest mystery of this great credit crisis is how some mortgage defaults in a relatively small market, a subprime market, initially worth only $200 to $300 billion, could topple a world financial system worth several hundred trillion dollars. How could some collapsing mortgages bring about the worst financial crisis since the 30s? The answer is that the credit crisis reflected something larger and more fundamental than a mere problem of mortgage defaults. The crisis erupted in large part because global markets declared a buyer's strike against our less than transparent financial architecture. The sophisticated paper assets, including securitization, that financial institutions use to measure risk and deploy capital. The housing crisis was a mere trigger for a collapse of trust in paper. followed by a deleveraging of the entire bloated with credit global financial system. Now, in last weekend's Wall Street Journal, J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon wrote an op-ed in which he chastised the thrifts and other non-money center bank financial institutions for what he's called overly aggressive mortgage lending practices, which is they probably did. But the chairman, in my opinion, has gall because his piece conveniently overlooked the main culprit for the crisis, the big Wall Street banks and investment banks themselves. Now, here's how events unfolded. In 1998, Wall Street was flooded with this dangerous ocean of capital, of excess savings. So the bankers, to increase their fee and bonus income, received permission to deploy a new business model involving securitization. In the past, I, as a banker, would lend you money for a mortgage based on my assessment of your character and financial base. If you were a small business, I would bring together other banker friends and we would offer you a syndicated loan. But again, based on our comfort with your reputation and strength of your firm's balance sheet. In both cases, as a banker, I had skin in the game. We knew each other, but that wouldn't last for long. The new model for handling risk and distributing capital, the securitization model, no longer required the big banks to have much skin in the game. For many people, the concept of a securitized asset or a mortgage-backed security is a mystery. So let me offer this analogy, because I think it's important to understand how we got where we are. As a banker, what if I took the thousands of mortgage loans I had issued and piled them onto a table and sliced and diced them up into small pieces like a giant, beautiful tossed salad? Then for a nice big fee, what if I sold individual salad bowls of these bits of diversified assets all over the world? I'll call the salad bowls mortgage-backed securities. And each salad bowl will carry a report card issued by a credit rating agency, such as Moody's or Standard & Poor's. But of course, there's no way logistically to investigate the content of each individual salad. So the final rating would be determined based merely on an educated guess, on mathematical modeling. For a while, the system worked spectacularly. Securitization became particularly useful in the financing of the expansion in the developing world. It worked out great for the banks as well. In the 5 months prior to the outbreak of the credit crisis, for example, some of Wall Street banks, because of the huge fees earned through this process of securitization, were achieving a rate of return in excess of between 30 and 35%. And I can tell you from experience that during that particular period, some of the world's savviest investors, including George Soros and Warren Buffett, were achieving rates of return of only half that amount. Nobody, including the regulators, ever asked how the bankers could overnight have become such brilliant investors. Then something happened to fundamentally change the financial world. In the fall of 2007, some global investors noticed that every once in a while, one of the salad bowls contained a piece of lettuce under which was a tiny speck of toxic waste in the form of a defaulting subprime loan. Now, there weren't many of these contaminated pieces, but if you ate that salad speck, you'd be dead. The only problem, no one knew which bowls of salad contained the toxic waste. That's called a problem of transparency. And in financial markets, when transparency is compromised, bad things happen. Suddenly, the global investment community was no longer ordering salad. They had suddenly declared a buyer strike against the sophisticated paper instruments of securitization that formed one of the main windpipes of our financial system. The unpurchased salad began piling up. Our financial system began wheezing for lack of financial oxygen. Then the patient turned red, then blue, then all hell broke loose. And although the central bank's actions around the world since then have unclogged the patient's windpipe some, things have yet to return to normal. And one reason is that despite government's quick efforts at reform, including the bank stress tests, the suspicion is that the industrialized world banks still have balance sheets with murky balances, including off-balance sheet liabilities that reflect overly optimistic valuations. So at the heart of the great credit crisis was not the fact that some financial institutions made mortgages to poor people who defaulted on those loans at a rate 3 times higher than normal. Such political banking shouldn't have happened, but if it was all just about mortgages, the global financial market would have experienced merely a bumpy 6 or 8 weeks of turbulence. Instead, the credit crisis involved something far more fundamental, the collapse of global investor confidence in our financial architecture itself. The fact is, we have surrendered control of our financial system to 5,000 specialists who are the only people who can understand the nature of these sophisticated financial instruments, particularly during a crisis. Global investors concluded our complex financial system, including our system of shadow banking, no longer accurately measured risk. And this lack of transparency was exacerbated by the realization that the financial system had implemented unheard-of amounts of leverage to maximize the fee accumulation from the issuance of this dubious financial paper. To make matters worse, this dubious paper was insured by mountains of even more dubious financial paper, those notorious credit default swaps, where again, the only measure of risk and value was a sophisticated guess that proved in the end to be not that sophisticated. Our large financial institutions borrowed massively from the global ocean of capital to magnify their positions in the markets and to magnify their fee income. The failed U.S. bank or investment bank, Bear Stearns, engaged in dangerous leverage, 34 to 1. Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, the U.S. financial institutions which enjoy an implicit government guarantee, use leverage of about 75 to 1. But the grand prize goes to the German bank, Hypo Real Estate, which actually had been, part of it had been an Irish bank. And they employed the leverage of a lunatic, 112 to 1. Now, there's a common belief that the financial crisis was a result of a complete lack of regulation. But that's only partly true and, in fact, oversimplifies the situation. It is true things like the derivatives market were unregulated entities. And I think the Obama administration's proposal for regulatory clearinghouse facilities, while not perfect, represents a realistic reform. The futures markets have deployed the clearinghouse concept for more than a decade to great success. But the sad thing is that the global financial system actually had rules, which if followed would have protected against a lot of the reckless risk. The BIS capital adequacy standards stipulate that banks, if they take on additional risk, and the issuance of mountains of mortgage-backed securities certainly qualifies, must set aside additional emergency rainy day capital. But for the banks, setting aside more capital would have hurt earnings. So for more than a decade, they deployed a scheme to circumvent risk. Out of sheer greed, the banks and investment banks nearly tanked the world economy. Now, to maneuver around, and this is the story I got to tell you that a lot of the big bankers don't like to hear, and they find it objectionable, but to maneuver around the BIS requirements, the banks and investment banks set up a kind of dual market. Almost every large financial institution set up independent, off-balance sheet financial vehicles in a legal, and I emphasize the word legal, attempt to obscure risk. The outside world, including the bank regulators and credit rating agencies, thought the bank balance sheets looked great. What the world couldn't see were the obscure, independent vehicles separate from the parent institutions. But you're probably asking, why would a bank set up a separate vehicle not under its own ownership or control? The answer is that the banks created their own private market, a kind of automatic legal dumping ground for asset-backed securities with enormous fee income. But then things got complicated. The independent vehicles, using the just-purchased mortgage-backed securities as collateral, issued commercial paper to the global financial market. And when the global housing bubble burst in 2007, global markets suddenly became distrustful of that commercial paper issued by the independent vehicles. The commercial paper, as you all know, collapsed. Now the world had a reason to hate America. The banks had made a foolish bet. They bet that if the paper went bad, they could cut and run. Unfortunately for the banks, global traders tied the parent and independent vehicles together by reputation. In other words, Citigroup, as the parent company, was no different than Citigroup's independent vehicles. And when this crisis hit, Citigroup's stock went down almost as fast as the stock of its independent vehicles. Now, for the Obama administration has come out with its financial regulatory reform plan, which is already being attacked by the left as too timid, and by the right as downright onerous. Let me offer a third opinion. This is the view of the agnostic. Having worked daily with financial traders for nearly a quarter century, I'm frankly not sure any government regulator is capable of going toe-to-toe with the Wall Street wizards and their lawyers, who begin figuring legal ways around the regulations at times even before the regulations are promulgated. I recently asked a Goldman Sachs executive, if you found a brilliant regulator, you'd hire her, wouldn't you? And his response, in a New York minute. I mean, today a senior regulator at the SEC earns between $160,000 and $190,000 a year, with some earnings slightly more. Executive secretaries at Goldman Sachs can earn $200,000 a year. Typically, executives earn in the millions, and so it's not an equal match. It's not an equal talent match. Washington is looking for a quick regulatory fix. But the problem may also relate more to the crumbling of the fundamental ethical underpinnings of our society. The financial crisis may say a lot more about what we have become as a people. Now, I still favor our Anglo-Saxon version of capitalism, which tolerates the drive for individual self-interest and shareholder value, simply because in the end, this system historically has delivered. During the 1990s, for example, under Bill Clinton, this system created 20 million net new jobs. And during the same period, the German financial system of universal banking, which supposedly is a system more concerned with the collective good, produced about a dozen new jobs. But make no mistake, our Anglo-Saxon approach to markets is prone to abuse. It is the necessary evil we can neither live with nor without, but no matter how clever Tim Geithner thinks he is in reforming the system of making and selling salad, it's not going to be perfect. For our regulators, this is an unfair fight, which is why the public-private model of oversight, where the bankers along with the regulators watch each other, and the bankers watch over each other's shoulders because they all have skin in the game, it may be our only hope. That may be the model for the future. Now, since the outbreak of the crisis, the global economy has experienced a brutal financial deleveraging, not seen since the 1930s. The value of virtually every asset in the world has been reappraised downward, led by housing in the United States. The situation has been like an unstoppable force of nature, a swift downward tidal move. From August 2007 until last September, we experienced a mere financial crisis. Then, with the collapse in Lehman Brothers, came a full-blown global panic. Nobody trusted anybody or any institution, forcing our policymakers to pull out all the stops, with almost certain unintended consequences in the future. The U.S. budget deficit has quadrupled, and the Fed has doubled the liabilities on its balance sheet. Next year, federal spending is likely to reach 28% of GDP. Let me put that in perspective. Spending has exceeded 25% of GDP only four times in American history. I'll tell you the four: the Civil War, the Revolutionary War, World War I, and World War II. U.S. policymakers have had no choice. They've had to enter uncharted waters in their efforts to thaw credit markets and revive the economy. But these are extraordinary times. But let me propose a new thesis about what is really happening in the world economy. For the last 18 months, we have fixated on the financial crisis and the collapse in global demand brought about by the devastation collectively of household wealth, with American households alone losing at least $12 trillion in wealth collectively. What we have missed is that the very model under which the world has operated the last two decades, the emerging market export model, appears to be crash landing. We in America are fixated on our financial woes, yet this export model, crack up, threatens to dangerously heighten geopolitical risk. While the over, and my God, when you look at what's happening in Iran and elsewhere, geopolitical risk, I think, is going to be a big element in our future. While the overleveraged U.S. consumer had become the world's gluttonous consumer of last resort in the last decade or so, large parts of the world became dangerously export dependent. Now, recently, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner was in Beijing, and he was at Beijing University, and he gave a speech to assure the Chinese that despite declining U.S. financial credibility, their dollar investments were safe. The audience broke into laughter. Now, I believe the Chinese should be wary of such hubris. You know, while Americans' public finances are troubling, to say the least, Beijing and the rest of the world should examine the future of economies, including China's, that have in recent decades, under globalization, become overwhelmingly dependent on exports. Their future looks as problematic as the future of the debt-ridden United States. As ugly as the credit markets have been, trade has been worse. Since World War II, global trade has grown twice as fast as gross domestic product. But things have shifted with this downturn. For starters, the exports of the world's three biggest exporters, Germany, Japan, and China, are 35% lower than they were a year ago. With American imports down by roughly the same, two-way trade has contracted by $1.5 trillion. There are real questions as to whether this development is more than a temporary pullback based on the current macroeconomic conditions and will evolve into a quiet shift to a new era of deglobalization. Those in that snickering Chinese audience should consider that on paper, the United States actually looks relatively immune to this trade collapse. American exports are 11% of our GDP, according to the World Bank. Compare this to the exports to GDP ratios, for example, of China, 42%, South Korea, 46%, Germany, 47%, Thailand, 73%, and I can go on. Policymakers from these economies need to ask themselves, what happens if the U.S. consumer, the world's consumer of last resort, pulls back permanently, as seems distinctly possible? Recent surveys by the Harris Marketing Group and American Express show that Americans earning over $100,000 are responsible for 50% of retail sales and 70% of retail profits. These individuals in the survey say they are finding pleasure in pulling back. They now want to be more like their neighbors. To a point, this pullback makes sense. We've been over-consuming as a nation, but only to a point. It's true that the export-dependent countries are scrambling to stimulate domestic consumption. I mean, they know they're in trouble. But this will be tough, given that there are aging demographics almost across the board. As people age, they save less and they save more and consume less. In China, a country with no social security system or much in the way of a social safety net of government services, families save significant amounts of their income. And they'd save even more, except that the government and state-run corporations are even bigger savers, which has left families with relatively low incomes. In Germany, policymakers have gone out of their way to limit consumption and reduce wage gains as a means of dramatically improving their economy's global competitiveness. Yet with global demand now for German capital goods and automobiles waning, Germany is in trouble with serious industrial overcapacity, even as their consumption remains modest. The Germans' secret hope that the U.S. consumer locomotive starts moving again at full speed. Indeed, Europe's dirty little secret is that its banks are deeply exposed to loans made to emerging market trade financing, particularly to Eastern Europe. And I'll give you an example. Austria, member of the European Monetary Union, huge lender to Eastern Europe. Its loan exposure to Eastern Europe, and Eastern Europe's in deep trouble, is $290 billion. Austria's GDP is $370 billion. I'll give you another example to put this in perspective. The five largest banks in the United Kingdom, their financial exposure is 440% of GDP. Here's another example. There's a bank in Switzerland, UBS. Its financial exposure, one bank, is 430% of Switzerland's GDP, which is why Switzerland is now driving its currency down. It's doing all kinds of desperate things. The Europeans are not acknowledging this bank problem to the fullest extent for one reason. They believe that the U.S. consumer will come to the rescue, that the U.S. will, the locomotive will pick up, that will help the emerging markets, the European banks, those valuations of those assets will be okay. But they're betting on a big U.S. recovery, and it's a risky bet. Beijing, they boast of it, of their big stimulus package passed last year. Yet the government's efforts to stimulate domestic consumption appear, in my opinion, to be not much more than a large subsidized lending operation, a stimulus that will likely produce a spike in growth now, but is unlikely to be sustainable. Remember the big $4 trillion stimulus from last year that was passed? Well, a lot of that stimulus was supposed to arrive, I think 60% of it, was supposed to derive from spending by regional and local governments that so far hasn't materialized. That's why the Chinese began last quarter lending. Just they would lend to a yellow dog, a loan without collateral. Anybody got a loan in the regional area because they suddenly discovered their regional governments were not stimulating. But I think something more fundamental is at work. Transforming China into a consumer economy to compensate for its lost exports will take years. Meanwhile, the theory that China's big stimulus will rejuvenate the rest of Asia and that the rest of Asia, including China, will decouple from the world, that theory is crash landing too. Last month, Japan's exports to China dropped by 30%, and that's an accelerated decline from the previous month. China's exports to Asia declined by 36%, again, an accelerated decline from the previous month. The Chinese leadership talks of having already emerged from the global recession. Yet China's recent aggressive trade conflicts and provocative strategic positioning toward India indicate just the opposite. Trade is 42% of China's GDP. Global trade has collapsed. It's probably not going to come back to where it had been. China has a problem. It's not surprising that geopolitical risk is soaring and China is hardly helping the situation, a fact that I think is underappreciated by global equity markets. Now, I believe we are seeing a stealth-like shift toward deglobalization. World governments should listen carefully to President Obama, who is a leader with an uncanny ability to make activist, even radical-sounding proposals. He can make them sound benign. At the recent Group of 20 summit in London, for instance, Obama said that the United States cannot be the world's consumer. Now, on the surface, this sounds like a statement about the temporary condition of the business cycle. But actually, Obama was talking about something far more significant. Not outright Smoot-Hawley-style protectionism, which he's too smart to propose something like that, but simply a coming policy of small tax spending and regulatory changes that will encourage this quiet trend toward deglobalization. Like it or not, this shift reflects a growing Washington mindset that globalization has gone too far. Witness the Buy American provisions on Capitol Hill and China's own new Buy American, or Buy China, policy. Obama is playing not only to his union supporters, but also to a segment of the U.S. corporate community whose enthusiasm for the global supply chain and just-in-time inventory management is waning. The Europeans are following the same route. In responding to the financial crisis, the European governments themselves found surprising difficulty arriving at a unified response, and they largely preferred a go-it-alone approach. And go-it-alone is the topic in the air these days in the international community. Let me add that the coming rise in global shipping costs has the potential to turbocharge this deglobalization process. The UN agreement last October on sulfur-burning levels for ships, and not to mention the California's own restrictions on ship emissions, which are coming into place, they could send shipping costs skyrocketing. A decade from now, it may be profitable to send by sea only items with relatively high value-to-weight ratios, such as laptops. The net result could well be that a lot of low-wage jobs that moved to India, China, and other emerging markets in the past will move back to the West. And you can see this already happening in the furniture industry. But here's the punchline. A capital-dependent America can't easily decouple from the world, nor can we separate ourselves and isolate ourselves from geopolitical risk. For now, America needs the world's capital as much as the world needs American consumers, an economic situation tantamount to a policy of mutual assured destruction. True, the global system needs rebalancing, and it needs it desperately. But until that happens, the Chinese should stop snickering at our Treasury Secretary and weigh the fact that this interconnected world of finance and trade, that in this interconnected world of finance and trade, there are likely, at least for a while, no easy escape routes of independence. That's why the world's prominent economies need to think seriously about a joint effort to achieve a permanent worldwide recovery despite serious headwinds. In the end, globalization is the great paradox of our time. On the one hand, it produced unprecedented wealth creation and brought a billion people out of poverty. On the other hand, it distributed that wealth unequally, creating huge, troubling disparities in income while sending us on a terrifying roller coaster ride of financial terror that now could bankrupt us as our policymakers experiment with various remedies that are certain to have far-reaching unintended consequences. My worry is also that our policymakers will attempt to achieve economic and financial stability as an end goal, but that stability itself in the long run won't satisfy the American people. I mean, talk about heightened expectations. The median age American was born in 1966. All he or she has known are economies with unusually low levels of joblessness and high levels of GDP. Now they're about to face potentially a world of diminished economic performance. Our policymakers will face some serious questions. Can we effectively roll back globalization? Or can we have smart globalization? And what level of financial risk from now on is considered reckless, and what level is considered dangerously inadequate? And who decides in today's economic system of enormous complexity how much leverage is adequate? What wizard is smart enough to figure that out? Nothing about the coming world, will be easy. The big Wall Street banks deserve to be fitted with straitjackets. And I'm almost done here. But having the banks become like water or electric utilities, while it is what they deserve, may limit the distribution of risk capital to business startups and small businesses, which Barack Obama says are responsible for 70% of all net new jobs. But then again, can we ever trust Wall Street again? Let me end with a word about where things go from here. The good news is that the world is not lacking in capital. Today there's plenty of capital, a lot of it still on the sidelines. This includes as much as $6 trillion in money market funds alone globally. Global stock markets have rebounded some, and this has created 10, 11, maybe 12 trillion in corporate equity value. Corporate debt yields have fallen. The stock surge is important as long as we remember that the stock market in the 1930s rose by more than 20% on five separate occasions. The bad news is that consumer spending, 70% of our economy, could continue in the doldrums for a long time. U.S. households are still shell-shocked, having lost $12 trillion collectively in household wealth. People are spending just on what is essential. Neiman Marcus is down 30%, Walmart up 3%. Sounds fine, unless you happen to work for one of the suppliers of Neiman Marcus. The most troubling issue here is interest rates. Since Christmas, U.S. long-term rates have nearly doubled, and now they've recently come down as the Federal Reserve has taken the unusual step of purchasing Treasury bonds. To many bond traders, this has been an early Christmas present, a huge wealth transfer from U.S. taxpayers to bond market short sellers, and this is potentially an explosive issue politically, so the Fed's purchases in the bond market are likely not to continue much longer, in my opinion. Washington is struggling to find an answer to why rates are rising. The administration says that while we are still in recession, the depression scenario of last December is now off the table. Thus, the market is simply adjusting rates to this new reality, up slightly. The Chinese and others finger America's extraordinary budget deficits, a lot of which President Obama inherited. The Chinese fear that the Federal Reserve will monetize Obama's quadruple budget deficits and produce higher inflation. The truth is that the deficit has been an unreliable economic predictor. The reason stems from this ocean of capital I've been talking about. For example, interest rates, the 10-year Treasury bond, never dropped below 5.25% the entire 8 years of the Clinton administration, which produced record budget surpluses. Yet at one point during the deficit-ridden George Bush administration, long-term rates dropped to 3%, and at a time of relatively robust growth. Here's another oddity. When inflationary expectations rise, long-term interest rates are supposed to rise. In mid-2007, inflationary expectations are around 3.2%. A year later, they jumped to 5.2, the highest level in 25 years, and yet long-term interest rates dropped. Running large budget deficits for long is a crazy way to operate an economy. It means sacrificing control to outside interests. But it's important as we work our way out of this deficit stranglehold to understand the nature of this globalized system. Even the best minds sometimes have trouble figuring it out. A few years ago, Warren Buffett, who was concerned about America's big budget deficits, bet big on a dollar freefall, arguing that foreign investors would flee the dollar in droves. And Buffett called his trade a slam dunk, and he lost $1 billion. Why have even the experts been wrong? A good guess is that they underestimated America's ability to import capital. Buffett was correct that foreigners were concerned about America's deficits, but it turned out they cared even more about the attractiveness of U.S. asset markets relative to the asset markets elsewhere. Yet just because the U.S. dodged the deficit bullet in the past is no guarantee for the future, particularly if there are concerns about the attractiveness of the United States as an investment target. President Obama promises that his health care reforms will produce big budgetary savings, and I hope so. But after the Second World War, America grew out from under a massive deficit. But that was after 4 years of pent-up demand followed by unprecedented optimism. By contrast, consumers today are in a gloomy period of deleveraging. That leaves investment as the primary growth engine. The president wants government investment in new green technologies as the game changer for the 21st century. All well and good, but we wouldn't have had the internet had there not been Pentagon investment. But my concern is with timing. It could take 2, 3, or even 4 years to sort out the winners and losers in government investment efforts. That's a similar situation to what happened when, after the financial liberalization of the late 70s, a lot of venture capital appeared in the 80s. It took years to sort the winners out from the losers before the general investment community plowed in. That's why Barack Obama will have no choice, in my opinion, but to try to stimulate private investment and innovation, which is likely to have a far broader and more immediate impact. A lot of the recently enacted stimulus spending is yet to kick in, and it will come in slowly. For example, if you look at the Department of Transportation website, $19 billion from last year's stimulus, only $369 million spent so far. Now, let me just end with this. I started this discussion by mentioning Tom Friedman. And let me end with Tom, who wrote, I thought, a brilliant column this past weekend on the essential role of innovation in our economy. Without an explosion in innovation, Washington, in trying to confront the deficit, could be in a situation not unlike rearranging the chairs on the Titanic. But innovation entails risk-taking. And my great fear is that we are moving from a period of reckless financial risk-taking to a situation that could be even more dangerous, as hard as that is to believe, no financial risk-taking. If you listen to policymakers, they're always talking about liquidity. We're providing liquidity, Ben Bernanke assures us, as the banks refuse to lend and companies refuse to borrow. But when all is said and done, economies are influenced by more than numbers, by more than the size of central bank liquidity injections. At the end of the day, the definition of liquidity comes down to one word, confidence. Liquidity is confidence. And if our leaders can restore confidence, the financial system will begin operating efficiently, and I predict will rise out of today's quagmire, perhaps even sooner than expected. Thank you very much. I guess we have one question, I guess. Yes, sir. Say the last couple words.
What happens to our American economy if, say, in 3 years, the American people go back to their excessive consumption? They seem to, as I've watched people, they seem to just want to always go back to consumption.
I think there is that. I think the regulators now are so terrified. I think the danger is that they're not going to be able, the consumers are not going to be able to get the kind of unbelievable credit opportunities that they had in the past. I think it's going to be tightly reined. Anyway, thank you all for coming, and it's great to be with you.
Thank you, David. A couple logistical notes. First of all, this may come as a surprise to you, but we have your book for sale out in the hallway. If you'd like David to sign the book, you have two opportunities. One is right now in the hallway. The second one is at 4 p.m. today in front of the Pepke building, where you'll be signing books again, I believe. Of course, shuttles are available in front of the Jerome right now to take you to your next class. Once again, thank you very much for coming, and enjoy the week. So we ought to usher you.